Ms. Robinson, would you like to reserve some time for a rebuttal, ma'am?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 6 minutes.
Sure. 6 minutes. Come on up. We're happy to hear from you.
May it please the court. My name is Rachel Robinson. I represent Mr. Robinson in this case. No relation. Mr. Robinson himself, to this day, still does not know what conduct of his violated Loudoun County Ordinance 654.09. The Commonwealth argued at trial that it was any number of actions or inactions that so violated the ordinance, including not answering the knock at his door, not presenting himself to the deputies, and making the deputies take 1 hour to execute the arrest warrant. For numerous reasons, this unclarity results from the ordinance being void for vagueness and overbroad under the 14th Amendment due process requirement. This ordinance allows for prosecution for mere annoyance and disruption. It invites arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement, and no ordinary person can predict where the line is that they are not allowed to cross with any particular deputy. In fact, any particular person wouldn't have to even know that they've encountered or delayed a deputy. If it's a plainclothes officer, this ordinance would still apply and still be able to be prosecuted. It includes questioning a deputy or protesting his or her actions. If that delays or hinders a deputy, that's prescribed under the statute, under this ordinance. Regarding the First Amendment and how it plays with this statute, the ordinance doesn't make any attempt to narrow its parameters or to tailor itself. It doesn't avoid infringing upon citizens' lawful protest or speech or questioning of an officer. To quote Martilla and Houston v. Hill, the First Amendment protects a significant amount of verbal criticism and challenge directed at police officers. Speech is often provocative and challenging, but it is nevertheless protected against censorship or punishment unless shown likely to produce a clear and present danger of a serious substantive evil that arises far above public inconvenience, annoyance, or unrest. The freedom of individuals verbally to oppose or challenge police action without thereby risking arrest is one of the principal characteristics by which we distinguish a free nation from a police state.
Counsel, are you alleging that that your client was prohibited in some way verbally? Do the facts in this case have were verbal altercation present in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand why the court would ask that. In this particular case, because neither the Commonwealth nor the court nor the jury narrowed their verdict to tell us what action they decided was in violation of the ordinance, it includes all conduct that was presented to them in evidence. Some of that conduct were Mr. Robinson's own statements when he was encountered by deputies, where he said, "I'm just arriving home. My neighbors gave me permission to come through their yard. And also my mother's coming. She's not going to know what happened or what's happened to her house." Which each of those caused a different delay. His saying that he just arrived home and that he had permission to come through his neighbor's yard caused the deputies to have to do further investigation than they were planning to have to do on this arrest warrant. They had to go talk to the neighbors. When he said that his mother was coming home and wouldn't know what was happening, out of courtesy, they left a note to let her know why her door was damaged and what had happened. All of those things caused delay. And under this ordinance, all of those things were prescribed. They could have been the reason that he was convicted. I don't believe it necessarily came into evidence at this particular trial. However, had Mr. Robinson questioned the deputies, and under the First Amendment, Mr. Robinson can challenge it not only as it applied to him, but also on his face. And Mr. Robinson, had he questioned the deputies, what is this arrest warrant for? Where are you taking me? Do I need to bring my cell phone and keys with me? May I leave them in the house? May I let the dog out into the backyard because no one else will be home? Any of those requests, any of those questions, which are all lawful, those are now made unlawful by this ordinance. We call it the hindering ordinance because that's how it's used. It's if you delay a deputy in any way, or we can in any way think that, you're able to be charged in Loudoun, and in this case, convicted. I think that's frightful. I also imagine that this court would want me to address the issue of whether all of the parties were named appropriately, as was raised in the brief for the appellee. And I'll just point the court primarily, unless you'd like to hear further, to the Roberson case. I think Gamashui, and Roberson really answer that under these specific circumstances, which I'm not sure have arisen in this court exactly this way before. The party who prosecuted the case the entire proceeding, without there being a combined circumstance of a state and a local charge, had notice. And the Loudoun County has actual notice at this point, and still the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Commonwealth's office, filed the brief of appellee. And where that's the case, I think even if there was an issue, it's been waived, and this case should proceed and be decided on the merits at this stage. Unless the court has further questions, I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Fine.
Ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, and good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Jason Grayson. I represent the government in this afternoon's oral argument. This appeal concerns Loudoun County Ordinance 654.09, which prohibits a person from resisting, hindering, or obstructing a Loudoun County deputy sheriff who is engaged in serving a warrant, order, notice of process, or is otherwise engaged in the ordinary course of her duties. The outcome of this appeal turns on several key issues. The first question before the court and was addressed in the Commonwealth's brief, which concerns whether the appeal has ripened such that the court has jurisdiction to hear the case. This Commonwealth argues that it does not. Commonwealth argues that the appellant created a material defect in its appeal when it failed to join the County of Loudoun as a party to litigation in its November 30th notice of appeal. Only the Commonwealth of Virginia was listed as a party to litigation. Neither the County of Loudoun nor the county attorney were listed as a party to litigation. It was never listed in its certificate of service, and it was never joined as a material party in the case accordingly. It was never given notice or an opportunity to participate in the appellate proceeding despite the requirements of Rule 5A6, which states that the appellant shall list in the notice of appeal, the names, addresses, and information, contact information, all the appellants and appellees, the people who have a stake in the outcome of the litigation. As this court noted in the case of Woody versus Commonwealth, such requirements have been characterized to be mandatory because notices of appeal work to transfer the jurisdiction of a case from the trial court to the court of appeals. They join the indispensable and necessary parties to the appeal by subjecting them to the authority of the appellate courts. Woody is a valuable analog in our case because its procedural situation is fairly similar to ours. Woody also involved a county ordinance, and like our case, the appellant failed to include the county in its notice of appeal.
Can I ask you on that?
Yes, sir.
Given what happened in December and then in January in this year where the court suspended the time to file appellee's brief and the style of the case was changed and the county received notice and county was advised to file brief, why doesn't that essentially cure any problems? Because everybody's on notice then, has had an opportunity to argue to the court, and no one's surprised anymore.
Understood. Well, Your Honor, I think we have to look objectively at the actions of the appellant from the beginning of litigation, from the notice of appeal through the briefing process. While it is true the style of the case changed when the Attorney General retracted their participation from the litigation. This Commonwealth's understanding is that the County of Loudoun was still never served, nor their attorney were ever served with any types of formal notices of the material proceedings in the case. I understand from the appellant's supplemental brief that they may have had informal contact, but that sort of retroactive contact isn't going to cure such a material defect in those proceedings. And the question isn't as much what action or what response the county may have informally made after the fact. It's did the county have a legitimate opportunity to engage itself in the litigation? And under the circumstances, it was precluded from doing so because it was entitled to notice in this Commonwealth's position from the beginning of litigation up through the briefing process. Even after the briefing schedule was changed, the County of Loudoun was still never served and still never had an opportunity to meaningfully participate in proceedings. And so I think that's what affects this court's jurisdiction over those cases, because they were never adjoined by the actions of the appellant in properly noticing the parties.
Well, counsel, you yes, allude to the Woody case.
Yes,
and in that case, there was a problem because it was a joint prosecution with the state and the county.
Correct.
And only the Commonwealth had been served, not the county, and it was a county ordinance. That differs in many ways from in this case, although it's a county ordinance. The Commonwealth prosecuted it all the way through. Isn't that right?
Yes, ma'am. That's correct. I would tell the court that the County of Loudoun and the Commonwealth's attorney are distinct and separate sovereigns, as we attempted to lay out in our brief. The Commonwealth's attorney obviously represents the executive function of government on the local level. The County of Loudoun represents the Board of Supervisors, who is also a distinct and legitimate stakeholder in the outcome of litigation. Certainly, they fashioned the ordinance. They bear the benefits, or they bear the responsibility, the costs of incarceration when people are convicted under the ordinance. They also benefit from the ordinance when costs and fines are assessed. So I think it bears some mentioning that the County of Loudoun has a significant stake in the outcome of this litigation, and because they do, they are an essential party. They would be affected by this litigation, and I would argue to the court that the Commonwealth's attorney is not the proper entity to represent the complete interests of the County Board of Supervisors.
And I don't want to blindside you with an unpublished case, but this just in case you were aware of it, this particular ordinance was the subject of another appeal on a sufficiency issue, Roberts versus the County of Loudoun, in which case the Commonwealth's attorney handled the case through prosecution at the trial level up through appeal. Now, I will tell you, you know, it's an unpublished case, and I don't know that that particular issue was ever raised, but I think there is some precedent, certainly from the Commonwealth, which I understand is a different authority than the county, but taking the county essentially as your client to prosecute an appeal.
I understand, Judge, and I'm familiar somewhat with the Dre Martina Roberts case.
Okay.
In that case, I think this court took up the question of sufficiency
yes.
of the evidence. I don't know that particular question of sufficiency of notice to the parties and are all the legitimate stakeholders before the court. I don't know that question was ever raised in the Roberts case.
That's fair.
But I would just say that as a threshold matter, the appeal should be dismissed for want of jurisdiction for the reasons that we've talked about and the defect that exists as it's laid out in the brief and as it connects our litigation today to the Woody case.
Okay.
In moving on to the merits, there are two issues before the court concerning the merits of this particular ordinance. The first, of course, is a question regarding substantial overbreadth. The Commonwealth had argued that this ordinance is not overbroad on its face, such that it substantially captures protected speech under the First Amendment. And under Perkins versus Commonwealth, we assume, we in the judicial system presume, that the acts of the legislature are going to be constitutional. I think that puts this appellant in the position as the moving party of having to demonstrate that the ordinance is substantially overbroad or overburdens protected First Amendment speech. But according to Broderick versus Oklahoma, which was adopted by the Jaynes line of cases here in the Commonwealth, That court talked about the fact that rendering a statute void for facial overbreath has been employed sparingly and only as a matter of last resort. And that's not what this particular appellant is coming to court to argue to the court. They're not giving the court any other remedial measures, even assuming arguendo, even if overbreath was an issue, and I'm not conceding that point. I'm not conceding that it is overbroad, but even if that was the case, the appellant comes to court and says it's overbroad, and so the court should find the ordinance unconstitutional. And I think that the cases that we see in Broderick and Perkins, I think, compel us to find, even if there is some imperfection in the ordinance, to find some intermediary remedy. I think this court has the power to further expound upon this particular ordinance and to give clarification and definition to the meanings of the terms in the ordinance. I think we look at, and kind of getting into the argument concerning void for vagueness, I think we have a thorough and complete understanding of two of the primary terms that are a part of this ordinance. The first being obstruction. It has a lengthy and time-honored case in the Commonwealth of Virginia. It's been expounded upon in body of case law. I tell the court that also we understand certainly what resisting is. That also is embedded in statute. Our understanding of the term hindering comes from the Dre Martina Roberts case, which the court pointed out just a second ago. The court sensibly applied the dictionary definition of the term hindering to inform our understanding of what that expression means. This court has within its power the ability to expound on that definition, to add clarity for the parties and for courts that will use this case in the future. But I would also tell the court, in going back to Broderick for just a second, the court Broderick wrote that the traditional rules governing constitutional adjudication is the principle that a person to whom a statute may be constitutionally applied will not be heard to challenge that statute on the ground that it may be conceivably applied as unconstitutional to others in situations before the court. The Broderick court went on to acknowledge that a closely related principle is that constitutional rights are personal, may not be asserted vicariously. So we see in the Broderick cases, that the court does not favor vicarious assertion of unconstitutional overbreath. I think what it prefers is to see, in situations like this, we tailor our focus on what the facts were in this particular case. What did the defendant, what did the appellant do in the facts in the case at bar? And did his conduct specifically and obviously fall into those elements that were regulated by the ordinance? Certainly in this case that was true. When we look at the facts of this case, the deputies went to Mr. Robinson's door, knocked on his door. Mr. Robinson peered out of the window, and the deputies instructed him to open the door. He failed to do so, and for about a half an hour they were trying to get into the house with means that did not use force. Mr. Robinson then absconded the house and hid in the backyard. It took the deputies about an hour to find Mr. Robinson. Clearly, his conduct was sensibly regulated under this ordinance. He hindered these deputies. And so I think that the court in Broderick, I think, rightly would not favor his ability to vicariously assert constitutional arguments concerning facial overbreath, given that his conduct was so clearly captured by this ordinance.
Suppose he had just waited by the door instead of answering the door, or kept looking at the window. Would he be guilty of violating this ordinance if they eventually just had to come on in?
Your Honor, I would tell the court that yes, I believe that's true. I believe that he an act or omission under our understanding of the term hindering in Roberts, that omission that lack of action on his part.
Opening the door for the police when they came knocking.
Yes, Your Honor. At that point, they were engaged in the ordinary course of their duties, their official duties. They were going to serve a warrant, and on that basis, this Commonwealth's position is that he had an obligation to open the door and to not hinder or to impede that warrant service. I think that would certainly be precluded, or that would be acceptable. That would be captured conduct under the Roberts case. The United States Supreme Court has said that it will not impose such an expansive result where the chilling effect of an overbroad statute on constitutionally protected rights cannot justify prohibiting all enforcement of the law. I think it suffices to say there are substantial, the court went on to say in Hicks, there are substantial social costs created by the overbreath doctrine when it blocks the application of a law to constitutionally unprotected speech. A point I want to clarify after hearing my colleague talked just a second ago, and the court talked about this at trial and the argued motions. The gravamen of the offense and the primary focus of what the jury was considering and what the court was considering wasn't speech so much as action. Mr. Robinson's actions were the primary focus for the court. There were hardly any statements that were elicited from the police that were documented or that were testified about, and certainly it's his actions and not his speech that were at issue for the trial court. I would tell the court that on the strength of our arguments, it is constitutional, and ask the court to deny the appellant's motion. Thank you.
Thank you.
To try to hop right in, I'll go back to the jurisdictional argument just briefly. The Commonwealth is citing to Woody, which again is immediately distinguishable from the present case, both because it dealt with a combined local ordinance and state statute. And as the court pointed out, there's not only precedent for the Commonwealth being able to represent adequately the interests of Loudoun County. Also in Woody, no filings were made before the court granted that appellant's petition. And so essentially, no one had entered anything except for the petitioner. And then the court encountered this issue. In our case, the Commonwealth has already filed both the brief in opposition and the brief of appellee on behalf of the appellee and the respondent. Even if this court were to say Loudoun County is an essential party to the case, even if this court were to rule that way, which, again, I would argue, the Commonwealth has said that the county's interest is the fact that the county created the ordinance. However, our General Assembly has no standing or reason to be here when we appeal any state statute or a conviction under a state code. They're not entitled to notice and to make a filing. So I do think that that's a weak point as far as what the county's interest is. In fact, I think the county had more notice of the appeal in this case than they did of the actual proceedings in General District Court and Circuit Court. When this case went through a jury trial, Mr. Robinson certainly didn't have to give the county notice, and it's presumed the county had notice by their own deputy issuing the summons and by the Commonwealth's representation of them as their prosecutor. So then after, to have been additionally notified of the appeal and to make no filing, I think they certainly have waived any interest they may have had. But even if they did, I'd again point the court to Roberson, where the Supreme Court said, in that particular case, the Supreme Court said that the locality should have been notified. However, I still think that that case was in a different posture than ours. But even with that, the court rejected the Court of Appeals finding that that was the reason to dismiss the case. Instead, the Supreme Court said it's actually because jurisdiction is about having jurisdiction over the subject matter itself and the parties. It wasn't that the court didn't have the correct parties before it. It was that the appellant in that case had not identified the statute correctly. The appellant in Roberson had been confusing It was a DUI local ordinance that referenced the state code, 18266. And so by continually insisting that he was appealing the state code conviction, he never gave this court jurisdiction over the local ordinance. And so even there, this court considered a similar issue and said, that's not the reason to dismiss. So even if this court thought that the county should be included, dismissal is not the appropriate remedy. To move back to the constitutional issues, the heart of this case, regarding the idea that there's other remedies, there's social costs if you declare this ordinance unconstitutional, I think those are extremely limited. When the court looks at what governmental interest is being forwarded by this ordinance, it's essentially the protection of the convenience of sheriff's deputies. It doesn't have to do with violence. It doesn't have to do with citizens. It's about whether or not sheriff's deputies are delayed. And so on balance, with that being the governmental interest, with the amount of rights that it infringes upon, it is in no way outweighed. In fact, it's greatly outweighed by the constitutional rights of citizens in Loudoun. I would argue that essentially it'd have to be rewritten in order to be properly narrowed. And if the county were to try to rewrite it, I think essentially any of the legitimate purposes they may have been aiming at are already covered by state code sections, by the obstruction, the resisting arrest, assault and battery against a law enforcement officer, which all comparably also limit themselves so that they properly protect a governmental interest while being narrowly tailored to not infringe upon free speech or to be overly broad. For instance, in the assault and battery on a law enforcement officer, the individual has to know or have reason to know that the person is a law enforcement officer. Otherwise, it gets prosecuted as a normal assault and battery charge. It's only elevated with that additional element. And I think that the court will find the other cases that were mentioned by the Commonwealth are readily distinguishable. We are asking this court to declare Loudoun County Ordinance 654.09 unconstitutional, to vacate the appellant's conviction, and to dismiss the charge against him.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will come down and greet counsel. All rise.